All right. So, who are you?
Okay, I'm Gilad Braca. Probably best known for my work at Sun, where I was responsible for the specification of the Java programming language for a while and Java Virtual Machine. I've done a lot of work and research in object-oriented programming language and stuff like that. Come from the small talk world. What else is there to say? Yeah, that's kind of a high level.
Excellent. Now, you were a computational theologist. On earth is that?
Well, it's a title I made up because, you know, your regular titles are rather boring. And whatever I was back then, some sort of software engineer, that the title seemed rather boring. And so I wanted to find something a bit more interesting. And given the kind of work I was doing, I was interpreting the specifications, right? There were these books that pretty much mostly in English laid out what Java compiler and Java Virtual Machine should be doing. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of questions about them because it was a natural language document and people could say, oh, does this sentence mean this or that? And so I was often called upon to interpret them. And they had this sort of flavor of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and also this Talmudic flavor of very fine interpretation of words. So it was like theology, but it applied to computation. Hmm. It later turned out that other people are using the phrase computational theology in a totally different way. Hmm. But that's how I came up with it. And there was a web-based interface to produce your business cards, so I went ahead and formalized it.
That's awesome. So, what are you working on these days? I mean, I just was at your talk. You were talking about a new language that you've created.
Right. We're working on a language called Newspeak, which is a descendant of Smalltalk. There's several fairly important changes, but largely it's in very much in that spirit. Mm-hmm. We're having lots of fun doing that, and it's still evolving, and
sure,
maybe a while before we know where we end up.
Now, for the people out in the audience, Smalltalk is one of these languages where I've heard all day long people have said Smalltalk in various different circumstances. A couple of quick questions, just a little bit of what is it? I mean, is it a dynamic language, a static language? Just to kind of get people up to speed with when you say it's like Smalltalk, what does that mean?
Okay, so Smalltalk and anything in its spirit would be a dynamic language, very much so. Smalltalk isn't really used very widely. It's mostly nowadays legacy code for various people, but it's left an enormous intellectual footprint. You know, just like ancient Greek or something, maybe you don't use it anymore, but it's the ideas live on in different forms, often lobotomized, but nonetheless, they're definitely around. Because Smalltalk was the language that Xerox PARC worked with, one of several language projects, but one of the key ones. In the heyday of when the Ethernet was invented and Windows and GUIs and all these things, mm-hmm. The original system using GUIs and stuff was done in Smalltalk, and a bunch of other innovations, refactoring. I'd have to think there's a long list of ideas that first came up in that world and then found their way out.
Interesting. And so, I mean, it's interesting that now we are starting to see sort of the dynamic revolution, in a sense, with Ruby. And so, I mean, what about the history? I mean, there's a reason why people use static languages. They're very useful.
There are right? reasons. They are useful. Static typing has advantages and disadvantages. And partly these things are just history and evolution and things like that. They are technical points. You know, it's there, and some of them are overrated, and some of them are true. So people think that static typing helps you find errors, which sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. But that very much depends on your environment. Static typing grew out historically out of, in ancient times, as it were. You'd go and take your stack of cards and give it to as a batch job to the operators of your big IBM mainframe. Mm-hmm. And 2 days later, you'd come back and have a printout, and it would say, gee, your job was failed because, some tiny little error. Mm-hmm. And in that kind of culture and environment, it is natural to evolve. There's a high premium for making little mistakes, and it's really good to check early. Generally speaking, when the cost of an error is very high, you want to invest a lot in checking up front to eliminate them. Mm. When the cost of an error is very low, then the trade-off is different. When you have very good debuggers, when you have very good IDEs, which really can point you at the problem very quickly, you need that less. And these are different evolutionary paths. And sometimes they can complement each other. You don't have to have one or the other. You can have both in certain circumstances. Mm. So I think it's a historical development. It's also easier to optimize with static typing. And people used to be more concerned with performance. Now they're more concerned with developer time and flexibility. Sure. And so the trade-off is actually probably changing in favor of dynamic typing.
Excellent. So, I mean, I have noticed that, for example, in languages like C Sharp, they're adding functional constructs into the language, so such that now we have things like link, right, lambda expressions, etc.
Right, yeah, very good.
That's pretty interesting stuff. I mean, and you mentioned in your talk how you love functional programs.
Absolutely.
Programming, excuse me.
Yeah, so higher order functions are an enormously valuable technique that until people really use them, they may not realize what they're missing. And it's very good that this is getting more into the mainstream through various things. And it has a huge future for other reasons, right? The multi-core trend in architecture is going to basically change this completely, because then it won't be just a matter of using, you know, okay, we introduce Lambda into another language. That's not new, actually. It's very good that it's hitting the mainstream through C-sharp or otherwise. But Smalltalk had Lambdas in 1980, and there's no contradiction between that and object-oriented programming. Mm. But because of the multi-cores, you're going to see a trend to really do stuff that is purely functional, that doesn't have state, so that you can parallelize it to a fine grain automatically and take advantage of these multi-cores, which doing explicit threading and stuff isn't going to cut it.
Absolutely. I mean, I find it's interesting that the most popular languages in the world are imperative, right? I mean, if you think about it, I mean, many people program in Haskell.
Absolutely, and there's very good reasons for that. Not many is an understatement, but and there are other functional languages.
Sure.
But altogether, you know, you won't need an enormous, Yankee Stadium would suffice. But the thing about this is that, again, first of all, the world isn't, at some level, we do not perceive it as functional. Right, state changes. I mean, if you take the functional stuff very seriously, every time I look at you, there's someone else there. You just happen to have a very similar value. Your molecules are constituted in exactly the same configuration, but it's different, right? Because they deny time. Now, this is fundamental to human perception. So one set of difficulties comes from that. Another set of difficulty used to come from performance. Actually, they performed worse than imperative languages. Partly because it's hard to share something and reuse a computation, because it tends to get recomputed and so forth. Now, when you get to a point when you have 32 processors, and even if your functional language implementation is, say, 4 or 8 times slower, which it doesn't have to be that bad, but whatever it is, eventually the parallelism will be a win. Overall, it'll be faster to use it, which is one reason that is less of a concern. Another thing is the functional community culturally, an academic community, they tend to believe that programs should look a lot like mathematics. And given the state of general education, there are a lot of programmers who can't cope with that.
Sure.
And they may be right in some ways, because there's things about mathematics that don't scale well to programming, actually. And you can have that debate. I think we'll end up having functional programming languages that don't look like today's functional programming languages. They look more like things you're used to syntactically. They can still be object-oriented. Object orientation does not necessarily imply state. It's an organizational thing rather than a paradigm like imperative or functional or logic. So the right time will come, and someone will cook up the thing that will appeal to a wider audience. And the technology, you know, the cost, everything will come together in probably the next 5-10 years, and there'll be a huge change.
Excellent.
But that doesn't mean that millions of people will be programming in Haskell, I don't think.
No. Well, I mean, I think that is one of the reasons, as you had mentioned, that it isn't your natural inclination as a developer. Even if you're a good developer, let's say you're a UI type developer, you're not, you know, your natural inclination is going to use C++ or C# or VB.
You speak for yourself.
Speak for myself.
But certainly there is, I mean, as a fundamental issue, a functional language, it's harder to to deal with these issues of I/O and things that are naturally stateful in the world. There are mechanisms for dealing with it, like monads in Haskell, but they really require a degree in math and tend to take away from the advantages of functional programming in some way, because you still are sensitive to ordering. So there are reasons why you would tend in a lot of those applications not to naturally think of functional programming. But I would say you'd like to think in higher level terms than the languages you mentioned. And again, it's largely what people tend is what they know, right? What their education has taught them, and if they're not aware of what's out there, a lot of developers just don't know that you could do things differently.
Good point. So it is, you mentioned, I mean, one of the things is if it is in fact possible to abstract away the complexities of functional programming. So in other words, make, like you had mentioned, so I have a statement type, language, but it's really a functional language. Well, how would that actually work semantically?
Well, so that actually was a very, very hard problem, and monads have sort of are a construct that I won't attempt to explain here, but that sort of solved that.
Huh.
The other, but what I was thinking was in terms of, it doesn't have to look like mathematics. It can. Part of it is just syntax. People are very sensitive to syntax, even though it's a very shallow thing. Part of it is organizationally, objects, being able to aggregate things and invoke methods dynamically. All that stuff can be done irrespective of whether a thing is stateful or not.
Mm.
And people have gotten used to that paradigm, and it's very valuable as an organizational way of thinking and structuring programs. And there's no reason to give that up just because you're giving up the state.
Hmm.
So there are answers for most of these things, and partly, these things come about when all the circumstances are ripe, when the multicores are more prevalent, when someone comes up with the right formulation, in terms of something that programmers will appeal to them.
Excellent.
So who knows? But it'll come.
So now, when Is it almost time for another revolution in general purpose programming? I mean, you know much about intentional programming? I mean, like paradigm shifts or
when was
the last paradigm shift in programming? C++? C?
What? It depends. Big paradigms, little paradigms, right? I think Java made a huge difference because garbage collection became mainstream.
Mm.
The general usage of object orientation came with C++, but even though it wasn't new to people who were in academia and so forth, but there's a question of how do you get it out there.
Hmm.
But all of these are still imperative. I mean, nothing has actually changed at that level ever.
Hmm.
Not since people started programming in Fortran in the mid-50s. The techniques have been refined a great deal, and luckily we don't have to be subjected to a Fortran 4 compiler anymore, but... imperatively, it's still, there's a variable, there's a sequence, you do this statement, you do that statement, here, this has this state, I mutate it. The paradigm hasn't changed, even with object orientation. It's changed the organization a great deal, it hasn't changed, the computational paradigm hasn't ever changed. But yes, the revolution is coming, and I think the next phase is likely to be functional, and you can see that it's in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, which is interesting. So everybody, start learning functional programming, right? I mean, what would be a good way for someone to get into functional programming without having to jump into Haskell? Have you seen F-sharp? What do you think of that?
F-sharp is great stuff. It's still a big jump for people, but of course it has the programming environments, and it is easier to tie to. If you get satisfaction from programming where you can see something real happen, it's probably easier because you can call on all these libraries and stuff. Another really good choice would be Erlang, which is a dynamically typed functional language that has really great properties and is picking up steam. And there's a great book out on that, the new Programming for a Concurrent World by Joe Armstrong.
Yeah, I want to interview him. He's here.
He's
right?
A great guy, and he's a great guy to interview too. So you could go with those. I suppose for most people that would be good advice. So that, you can sort of mix functional and non-functional in something like Scheme. But of course that for some people may be a big step because they won't adapt to the syntax or whatever. It depends how open-minded you are. It's a good idea to be open-minded, but
sure.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, this is true. Well, hey, I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what you had just talked about for an hour.
No, that's not good. I thought
it was very clear.
No, it is.
I just mean it's very low level. Well, parsing. You're talking about creating parsers.
Yeah, right? Well, it depends. If you do programming languages, you have to create parsers, and it's the basic part of what you do now. Not most people don't.
Yeah.
It's actually a very high level way of creating parsers, but most people prefer to have someone else create them for them, and that's fine. But you know, there's lessons there about organizing software in general, because these kind of combinator like approaches where you have uniform building blocks that snap together.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you can apply that to any problem domain, it really gets you a lot of leverage.
Absolutely, and certainly has an impact on composability.
Yeah, yes. And scalability and less bugs. It works out great.
Excellent. All right, well, it was great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.